This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, May 16, 2013. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram, sitting in for Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Washington, lawmakers question a 2001 law that Presidents Obama and Bush have used as permission for drone warfare and the indefinite detention of hundreds at Guantanamo Bay. Fracking leases on federal land are delayed in California as activists continue their push to stop the practice altogether. And as thousands of workers in Bangladesh garment factories go back to work, we'll talk to a labor rights advocate in Dhaka about the future of promised workplace reforms. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Less than a month ago, thousands of Bangladeshi garment workers died in one of the worst industrial disasters in history. Now in Cambodia, another major producer of Western clothing, an unconfirmed number of workers were killed and injured today when a roof collapsed at a foreign-owned shoe factory. FSRN's Joshua C. Robinson reports.
Details are still emerging after the disaster in Kampong Spo province, west of the capital Phnom Penh. Sources suggest the number of killed and injured may not be known for quite some time. What is known is that workers making products for a foreign-owned brand have again perished in an unsafe factory in Southeast Asia. The cause of the ceiling collapse is still unknown, but Cambodia-based photojournalist George Nichols says his experience shows the responsibility to ensure worker safety must rest on the companies that benefit from the cheap labor available, rather than individual governments or world bodies.
The company owners should put some health and safety structure within the factories that these people are working in, whether it's in India, Bangladesh, China, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, wherever. I think that Gap, Nike, whatever name, they should put some health and safety structure in place.
The current government has not been engaged in improving worker safety. And even though national elections are scheduled for the end of July, the main opposition candidate is in self-exile after being convicted for his role in a series of anti-government protests in 2009. Consequently, there is not likely to be any change in the status quo. Joshua C. Robinson, FSRN, Siem Reap, Cambodia.
A recent surge in violence and NATO troop deaths continued today in Afghanistan. A car bomb attack on a military convoy in Kabul left at least 15 people dead, most of them bystanders and children. Two soldiers and four civilian contractors were among those dead. Reuters reports they were all American. An insurgent group allied with the Taliban claimed responsibility. Since Monday, four members of the International Security Assistance Force have been killed in insurgent attacks. Iran said today it is willing to engage with world powers over its nuclear program, following a fresh round of talks with the European Union in Istanbul. FSRN's Jacob Reznik reports.
Expectations of a breakthrough this week had already been low, and there were no surprises today. Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, Saeed Jalili, spent more than an hour in front of reporters, reiterating that Iran would not abandon its right to enrich uranium, as enshrined in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Protocol, of which Iran is a signatory. Jalili has declared himself a presidential candidate and is not expected to take any political risk ahead of next month's polls. Last night, he met with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, who is representing the United States, Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany. Both sides reported progress without elaborating on details. This comes as U.S. lawmakers from both parties this week urged President Obama to expand sanctions on Iran over suspicions it may be secretly developing a nuclear weapon. Economic sanctions from the U.S. and EU have had a devastating effect on Iran's currency, with the rial losing about half its trading value in the past 12 months. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Today, Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley signed gun control legislation, making it one of the few states in the country to push through tighter controls in the wake of December's elementary school shooting in Connecticut. The Maryland Firearm Safety Act bans assault weapons, limits gun magazines to 10 bullets, and requires tougher background checks, fingerprinting, and safety training in order to purchase a handgun. Moms Rising founder Kristen Rao Finkbeiner says it's a win for families and community safety.
It's the first state in 20 years to require fingerprinting when you get a gun, and which is a wonderful thing.
The NRA has promised to challenge the new law in court. The Texas House of Representatives has approved a provision that would allow student organizations at public universities and colleges to deny members based on things like race, religion, and sexual orientation. FSRN's Teddy Wilson has more.
A piece of legislation that previously died in committee has been revived in the Texas House. Fort Worth Republican Matt Krause added an amendment to an unrelated higher education bill that would force colleges and universities to allow student groups to ban members who demonstrate, quote, opposition to the organization's stated beliefs and purposes. Chuck Smith is the executive director of Equality Texas.
We think this is outright and blatant discrimination and shouldn't be something that should be a part of higher education in the state of Texas, and that student organizations should comply with the non-discrimination policies of their campuses.
Smith said despite passage, he was encouraged by the narrow 78-67 vote and the bipartisan opposition. The amendment will now have to survive a conference committee to reconcile the different versions of the legislation. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, Texas.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Nell Abram in Tampa. Both the Bush and Obama administrations relied on a single law passed in 2001 to justify tactics used in the so-called war on terrorism, from drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, to the continued detention of nearly 200 men at Guantanamo Bay. The Senate Armed Services Committee questioned military officials and legal experts about that law today, asking if the authorization for use of military force needs to be limited, amended, or abolished. FSRN's Alice Olstein attended this morning's hearings and brings us this report.
Nearly 12 years have passed since Congress debated and approved the authorization for use of military force in the days following the 9/11 attacks. But neither lawmakers nor the public know how the law is being interpreted by the president and the military he commands. Many of the same senators that voted for the law back in 2001 asked Pentagon officials at Thursday's hearing, who do they consider an enemy combatant? What groups can be targeted? Where can the U.S. carry out military actions abroad? And how long will this law's powers and the U.S. government's war with al-Qaeda last?
Yes, sir. I think it's at least 10 to 20 years.
That's Assistant Defense Secretary Michael Sheehan, who also said the law empowers the military to carry out actions anywhere in the world against al-Qaeda and, quote, associated forces. He asked the Senate panel not to change the law in any way, saying the military has the authority it needs to successfully wage war against what he called an ongoing threat. But the text of the law only authorizes military actions against groups who carried out or supported the 9/11 attacks. Arizona Republican John McCain criticized military officials for improperly using it to justify attacking individuals and groups with little to no connection, including ones that didn't even form until years after 9/11.
So for you to come here and say, well, we don't need to change it, I think, or revise or update it, I think is, disturbing.
But McCain and several lawmakers don't want to get rid of the law. They want to expand it, to give the military the legal right to attack any group it considers a terrorist threat to the U.S. or its allies. Maine Independent Angus King also spoke in favor of revising the law. He accused Pentagon officials of rewriting the Constitution in interpreting the statute so broadly, saying they were trampling on the right of Congress to be the sole body responsible for declaring war.
I'm not disagreeing that we need to attack terrorism wherever it comes from and whoever's doing it. But what I'm saying is let's do it in a constitutional way, not by putting a gloss on a document that clearly won't support it. It just doesn't work. I don't understand. I mean, I do understand you're saying we don't need any change because of the way you read it, you could do anything.
King and the other committee members also questioned a panel of legal experts about the scope and constitutionality of the authorization and how the Obama administration is interpreting it. Kenneth Roth with Human Rights Watch told the senators that the law should be amended as quickly as possible to include an expiration date, since it currently allows for what he calls a forever war. He spoke to FSRN after the hearing.
When you go to war, there are lesser protections for certain key rights than when police actions are used. So the police can only use lethal force to meet an imminent lethal threat. They can only detain you with due process. But in war, combatants can be killed on the battlefield. People can be detained without charge or trial. So we should be very reluctant to use war powers. We should use them only really when necessary to meet a serious security threat. And the issue is not simply how will the U.S. act, but what kind of precedent is the U.S. setting for Russia or China, who all have their own security or political threats that they probably would be eager to use war powers against.
Roth also criticized the Obama administration for using the 2001 authorization to justify indefinite detention without trial at Guantanamo Bay, where more than 100 detainees are now on a multi-month hunger strike to call attention to their conditions. Human rights advocates across the country will hold protests Friday to call on President Obama to release the detainees who have been cleared of any crime and give fair trials to the rest. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In Bangladesh, hundreds of garment factories are set to reopen tomorrow. Industry officials had indefinitely shuttered the plants after nearly 2 weeks of protests. Workers at more than 300 factories in Ashulia, near Dhaka, demanded pay increases, benefits, and workplace safety at the plants that produce nearly 20% of the country's more than $19 billion garment export industry. The protests followed the collapse of the Rana Plaza factory complex, where authorities ended search and rescue efforts earlier this week. They removed more than 1,100 dead bodies from the site. At least 150 people are still listed as missing, and hundreds of bodies have yet to be identified. The Rana Plaza collapse was not an isolated incident. 5 months earlier, nearly 120 people died at the Tazreen factory in Ashulia. And as rescuers were still removing survivors from the Rana Plaza rubble, 8 workers were killed at Dhaka's Tung Hai sweater factory. The government has announced a number of initiatives to address labor issues in Bangladesh's garment sector, and some retailers have agreed to another safety accord. For more, we go to Dhaka and talk with Alonzo Susan, country director for the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center in Bangladesh. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
First, the government in Bangladesh says it will change the country's labor laws to allow workers to unionize without first getting permission from their employers. Officials also said they'll put in place a panel that will make recommendations about raising the minimum wage. What are your thoughts on these reforms?
I think those are good initial indication that they're going to address some of the issues that the trade unions have been asking here in Bangladesh. I mean, imagine that there's only 30 plant factory level unions out of over 5,000 garment factories. So anything that will help unions be able to organize at the factory level, that's a good thing. The issue of the minimum wage, the Ashulia incident that you mentioned, the big issue that the workers there are raising is the issue of the minimum wage. They're calling for an 8,000 taka, a minimum wage, which is equivalent to $100 a month.
These reforms are not a done deal. They still need to pass the parliament. Is that right?
Yes, it's not a done deal. There's a process that needs to be done in terms of the parliament needs to pass the labor law changes. There's a number of amendments that's been called for, and we're analyzing those things. In terms of the minimum wage, there's a minimum wage board that needs to be a panel that needs to be set up, a negotiation between the Bangladesh employers and the trade union and the government.
Alonzo Susan with the Bangladesh Solidarity Center. On the retail side, there's a safety accord that several big European-based retailers say they'll sign on to, including H&M, Dutch retailer CNA, and Britain's Primark stores. The plan would require safety inspections and has retailers fund some of the costs. Large retailers have pledged to commit to safety standards in the past. How is this different from past reforms?
Well, the way this accord is, there will be an independent body that will actually make the report. There's certain transparency and the result on those inspection that the independent inspector would be carried on, and that this accord is also binding, meaning that whatever comes out in terms of resolution, in terms of the differences, will be binding to the parties.
Notably absent from the deal are U.S. companies. The Gap, for example, this week expressed concern about legal liability in the deal.
Right. It's probably in the issue of the binding situation, meaning that they don't want to be held accountable to whatever decisions that be made.
New documents found at the site of the collapsed building and made public this week show that the Rana Plaza did produce clothing headed to Walmart. One document from April 2012 showed pricing for different styles of jeans, with prices from $3.41 to $4.50 per pair. Walmart has maintained that none of their products came from the factory at the time of the tragedy. What do you know about Walmart and this disaster?
Well, we don't have any concrete proof about Walmart. Walmart is the second largest brand that has a market share in Bangladesh. First one is H&M, second is Walmart. The fact that Walmart is one of the largest buyer, what I heard from different groups, and including manufacturers, that Walmart has a tendency to push the prices down. And essentially that push is creating a lot of shortcuts. Walmart's practices need to spend more on ethical buying.
Alonso Soussan, country director for the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center in Bangladesh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Cyclone Mahasan made landfall on Bangladesh's southern coast today, bringing heavy rain and wind. At least 11 people died. The storm's intensity weakened somewhat before it hit the coast, but tens of thousands of homes built largely with mud and straw were destroyed, leaving unknown numbers of people homeless. The United Nations Humanitarian Agency, or OCHA, is concerned about thousands of people in Myanmar's Rakhine State. Authorities in Bangladesh relocated hundreds of thousands of vulnerable people to safer ground before the storm hit. UN Radio's Don Bob talked to Kirsten Mildren, spokesperson for OCHA's Regional Office for Asia and the Pacific.
Well, the tropical cyclone over the last 24 hours, actually it's become a tropical storm, has certainly weakened. Its path has now gone north of Chittagong, which is the second largest city in Bangladesh, which has about 2.5 million people. They started receiving heavy rains and winds early this morning. They actually started their evacuation late last night. 1 million people were asked to evacuate to special cyclone shelters that Bangladesh has in the area. So since that time, they've basically been bracing winds, and the eye of the storm was expected to reach around this time right now, about 6 o'clock at night. We're still yet to see what the true impact is on the area and whether there are floods and what have you, which is usually associated with a storm like this. So that's for Bangladesh. For Myanmar, for Rakhine State, which we were also very concerned about, in Sitwe, I just spoke to my colleague then, and they still haven't received any rains, but he says it looks like they're coming. In northern Rakhine State, that was an area that we're most concerned about because it still looks like it will get quite a lot of rain from the storm, and we've yet to see what's going to happen there.
As you mentioned, Rakhine State, the people there didn't want to leave because they feel they'll not be allowed back. How much of a problem has that presented for OCHA in its preparations for the arrival of what was supposed to be the cyclone?
Well, I mean, we've been advocating for the last 6 months, the UN and NGOs, to the government that we needed to find good shelter for the IDPs, most of them in very inadequate accommodation. We're talking really flimsy tents and makeshift accommodation. We knew that the monsoon season was approaching. It starts in June. We were very concerned that something like this would happen, and the government was unable to find a solution. It quickly put together an evacuation plan really over the weekend. It's moved very quickly to try and activate that plan, and it had hope of moving about 160,000 people. It certainly hasn't been able to move that many people, and the most vulnerable, the most at risk, is about 40,000 people, and it may have moved that many. We're not sure. Many communities didn't go. They were certainly very fearful about moving with the military. They were very unsure of leaving their homes behind. There really hadn't been proper communication with these communities. They trusted the government to actually move. So it has been a real problem, and we don't know what's going to happen with the rains tonight. Many of them are unprotected.
I want to go back to Bangladesh. You mentioned that it was headed their way. First of all, how many people basically in high-risk areas, one, and two, what sort of assistance OCHA may have offered in the beginning in preparing for this storm?
Bangladesh hails itself as one of the most disaster-prepared countries in the world. They had a cyclone many years ago that killed an amazing number of people, and since then they have really put in an amazing sort of disaster preparedness program, which has to really look at cyclones, because every year cyclones hit that part of the world. So it has something called the cyclone zone, and they have thousands of cyclone shelters that people can go to. They have 50,000 community volunteers who go all throughout the area, and in this case it was 14 districts, alerting people that an evacuation was in place. They really are prepared for something like this. In terms of numbers of people that were at risk, we're hearing about 3 million, but it depends how far it goes, whether it reaches down to Cox's Bazar. Down there you've got a lot of refugees as well, who are not in as good accommodation as, say, people further north up in Chittagong, but they also heard the evacuation warnings, and they certainly moved.
That was UN Humanitarian Agency spokesperson Kirsten Mildren talking to UN Radio's Don Bob. In California, the Bureau of Land Management is postponing oil and gas land leases through September, putting a halt on potential new developments that would use hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, to extract shale oil reserves. Environmental groups say a recent court decision is making those leases more difficult to dole out, and more legal challenges are in the works to stop the practice. FSRN's Christina Anastad reports.
California has the largest shale oil deposits in the nation. Located in the Monterey Shale, which spans north of San Francisco south to Los Angeles, industries are vying to extract this fossil fuel using hydraulic fracturing. But David Hodstetter, an environmental attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity, says that process has grave impacts on the environment and human health.
For instance, in North Dakota, in 1 year, there were over 1,000 spills of oil and other fluids like fracking fluid. This can contaminate groundwater. For instance, EPA found that a fracking operation had contaminated a groundwater aquifer in Pavilion, Wyoming.
Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as it's commonly called, is a process to access deposits of oil or gas thousands of feet below the surface. Fracking wells extend laterally deep underground. Some can span for nearly 2 miles. The industry has used the process for decades in California, and it's fairly unregulated, says Hodstetter.
It's been happening in the state with absolutely no oversight. So if there have been problems, they would have gone unnoticed.
Our ability to regulate is limited.
Joe Scrivener is the Deputy State Director for Energy and Minerals at the Bureau of Land Management in California.
For routine hydraulic fracturing, the company doesn't need to tell us that they're going to do it, but they need to report it within 30 days of having done it. And for non-routine hydraulic fracturing, they have to make a proposal. Now, I'll be honest with you, and I'll tell you that our regulations do not define what routine and non-routine are.
Regulations are so lax, says Scrivener, they don't even know how many oil wells are being fracked in the state.
We don't really have records with great reliability as to how many have been fracked over the years going back in time. We have estimates. You hear a lot nationally about 90% of wells drilled in the last, I forget how many years, but the recent years have been hydraulically fractured. We think in California that number is actually about 30% or 33%, somewhere in there.
Because of its lax oversight, the Center for Biological Diversity sued the Bureau of Land Management twice, arguing the BLM failed to consider environmental impacts of fracking before issuing oil leases to companies to frack more land in California. Last month, the courts agreed with the center in one case. A second case is pending. Hodstetter says the ruling is forcing the Bureau to reassess its regulations.
The case that we won against BLM was a huge victory. It was a huge victory for the environment and public health. And the court's decision tells the Bureau to go back and consider the impacts of fracking, which include extreme impacts to public health, water, air, and the climate. And the fact that they have to stop now and consider all of those effects really could change the direction that they take with oil and gas leasing in the state.
But the BLM Scrivener contends their recent decision to suspend oil and gas leases in California has nothing to do with recent litigation.
The decision was made that based on workload and funding and work priorities that we would defer any further lease sales and that we would reevaluate in the fall for fiscal year 2014.
Fracking is a contentious issue. Last year, the BLM began a process to reassess its regulations around oil and gas development, including fracking. Democrat Rush Holt from New Jersey accused the Obama administration of weakening the proposed regulations, which have yet to be released. But environmental groups aren't giving up without a fight. Again, Hodstetter.
I think what we ultimately need is a halt to fracking. Fracking is an inherently dangerous process, and all the harms of fracking can't be prevented. And hopefully we see a prohibition on it.
As federal regulations are in the works, another pending lawsuit challenging the BLM's lax oversight of environmental impacts on the Monterey Shale is making its way through court. But that may have little impact on overall fracking in California, since Scrivener tells FSRN the Monterey Shale is tough geography for fracking, and only about 10% of fracking that occurs in the state is on BLM land. The rest is on private and state lands and subject to state oversight. To that end, three separate bills to put a moratorium on fracking in California recently passed the Assembly Natural Resources Committee. They head to the Appropriations Committee next. Christina Onnested, FSRN, California.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Kitabchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us at comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. Sitting in for Dorian Marina from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.